All right, well, good afternoon. Excuse me. Good afternoon, everybody. As always, this is Corey Worden. You're listening to the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialties Health Beat podcast. And today, as usual, we are also producing in coordination with the Association for Occupational Health Professionals and Healthcare, or AOHP, and their Caring for Healthcare Professionals podcast. So we're glad to hear everybody. Excuse me. We're glad to have everybody here today. Apparently my tongue is tied. And we've got some fantastic guests today. So you might remember Amber Johnson. We talked with her about a year and a half ago, maybe a year. We were talking about emergency management and how that relates to healthcare. And so she is joining us again today. And then we've also got a first-time guest, John Fleming, who is works in public health preparedness and does a fantastic job, particularly a lot of operations in the last several years in particular. So we're glad to have both them on board today, and we're going to talk about just that. We'll talk about emergency management, we'll talk about healthcare, talk about public health, and all of the stuff that goes into that, including safety management. So we're going to go ahead and get it going, but I don't want to speak for y'all. So if we could, if y'all can give our listeners just a quick intro about yourself, your work, experience, anything that you'd like to put on, you know, your little 60-second bio, we appreciate that. John, why don't we start with you? Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. That was a gracious introduction. So I've been working at public health for quite a while now. I've been doing this since the late 1990s. I came here to Texas in 2004 and got to play part in Hurricane Katrina response. And then, of course, we had Ike and Harvey, and then along came several biological threats like Zika and Ebola and, of course, H1N1 and now COVID, of course, and monkeypox, and now a little bit of Ebola coming back around as well. So we've been busy. My line of work is really about coordinating with different partners, primarily within the health department, but also a lot of external partners, to develop readiness and capabilities for these public health responses, ranging from pretty much all of the natural disasters and public health outbreaks. And because we're a full service health department, that also includes the human services element. So it's pretty broad base and very lively. Certainly in the last several years been very lively. And I'll hand it over to Amber.
Thank you, John. So my name is Amber Johnson. I am currently a emergency management consultant, but the majority of my career was spent working with the hospital preparedness program and then also leading the corporate emergency management department for a large healthcare system here in Houston. I am a certified emergency manager through the International Association of Emergency Management, and I have very much been enjoying this new venture into consulting, getting to see emergency management and different entities, different sectors, and from a national basis. And Corey, I'll turn it back over to you.
Cool, thanks. Well, that's fantastic. Definitely glad to have both y'all here. And I know y'all have done a wide variety and array of different types of operations, which is fantastic. So we'll go ahead and get right into it then. So the first things first, of course, you know, like y'all just said, y'all have worked in different capacities, whether it be public sector, public health, or whether it be large-scale hospital system, all different types of things. So in both those cases, what I'm curious about is how the emergency management construct works in terms of planning, preparedness, response, recovery, and how does that relate to the people that you serve? Like, and do you do planning? Do you do logistics, training? What are kind of the ins and outs and the different types of things that you provide? And of course, I know John kind of alluded to this already, but what types of situations have you done that for, like different types of natural disasters or biohazards, things of that nature? I'm kind of curious of the scale and the scope and the types of things that you do. Amber, why don't we start with you this time?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Corey. So after 9/11, there was a huge push in the emergency management industry of standardizing the practice and into those pieces that you just described, the preparedness and mitigation, the response and the recovery. Since starting consulting, I've gotten to see on a national level that that foundation remains the same, whether you're talking about a healthcare system or a private company, or a city or county, state, federal, that overall foundation and umbrella, remains the same in emergency management.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah, it's definitely a lot of standardization. I know, even in my experience, I was my first life, I was in the Air Force, and during that time was when the Air Force was going from what they used to call the Survival Recovery Center, and they changed to the National Incident Management System, which of course, because it's the military, they still had to change it and call it Air Force Incident Management System just because that's what they do. But a lot of standardization there, and it's always, I always tell this story when I talk to students, especially, is that, I didn't know that this was a job that people did until I was in the military. And then when I was in the military, we would teach the students. I was an emergency management instructor, and so we would teach the students about all of the different players in the ICS and in the NIMS and the EOC and whatnot. And one of them, of course, was the safety officer. And at that time, even after being in the military for 3 years, I didn't know that safety was a job that people did. I in the Air Force, what they teach you is that there's a safety officer who's assigned to the flight operations as the aviation safety officer, primarily to make sure the airplanes don't crash. And so when we taught that, we would basically say, one of the emergency support functions is the safety officer, or the part of the ICS structure is the safety officer, and their job is to make sure that the operation is safe. And then we would move right along. And so it's always funny to me how everything has evolved so much, especially in my perspective and in what I do now. But everything is definitely standardized, and that's always a good thing. So John, what are your thoughts in terms of public sector, public health? How does everything go for you?
Yeah, so the construct that we use, and this is pretty common across all of emergency management, but to look at, what are the planning elements and partners that we need to bring to the table? How do we organize? How do we train and equip, and finally exercise? So the acronym that creates is POETI. So plan, organize, equip, train, and exercise. So we apply that. That works quite well when you look at things through that lens. You're trying to address all of those elements. And then in terms of the capabilities that we're trying to build for public health, we kind of have a Bible from CDC on 15 capabilities. The first two are really focused on the community, so community preparedness, which really focuses on that kind of building that readiness for response. The second one is community recovery. So right off the bat, very strong focus on community. And then there's of course like 13 other capabilities that address epidemiology, lab, mass fatality, communications, information sharing, pharmaceutical interventions, non-pharmaceutical interventions, and things like isolation and quarantine. So pretty broad and definitely capturing all of the public health types of interventions, including the health-related and human services-related components or mass care-related components. And to give you an idea of just how diverse that can look, everybody's aware of what we've been doing for the last couple of years, going on 3 years now with COVID, first doing testing and then being able to do vaccinations, and similarly doing some of the same activities for monkeypox. But diverging from that a little bit for for Zika, we didn't have those kinds of interventions available to us. So we looked at what kinds of elements can we put in place to help reduce the risk of Zika transmission. And of course, Zika is transmitted by the mosquito. So one of the programs we set up at my office was to provide window screens to people whose homes did not have, you know, adequate window screens to keep the mosquitoes out of the house. So pretty diverse and different type of response compared to providing vaccinations. We always do quite a bit of outreach to the community, provide training opportunities, town hall meetings. A big portion of public health really is about getting the message out, raising awareness, helping people to make informed decisions. So that messaging component in the long run is probably about 90% of what we need to do and how we actually interact with the majority of the community. On the service side, we really are much more of a safety net type of provider. So the lion's share of the population should be getting their health services from private or commercial entities. And then the public sector or government sector really is that safety net provider with some key critical partners like the federally qualified health centers, community health centers, who really try to provide services to that underserved population. That's really our sweet spot, the underserved population, underrepresented, really the hard to reach folks. And in a lot of ways, they are the most at risk as well. They tend to be, people who have low incomes, language access issues, live in zip codes that, are in food deserts, have little to no access to healthcare. They tend to be uninsured or underinsured. You know, all of those complement of indicators that really speak to a high level of needs. With respect to public health, we focus a lot of effort on trying to reach those folks, get them into care, get them associated to medical homes, and we try to do that. My program is much more focused on the emergency side, but through the whole health department, some of those needs are there consistently, and we try to get them met, whether it's blue sky or red sky days. Lots of opportunity here.
That's great. And definitely very valuable work and very appreciated. It's interesting, as you were discussing that, I was thinking, as I was just having a conversation last week, we were speaking with some AmeriCorps volunteers, and I was explaining to them, they were asking, they said we're interested in learning about public safety. And I thought for a second, and I said, well, I said, I can tell you all about it. I said, but first I need to ask you some clarifying questions. I said, because the reality is that within just the health department alone, you've got an enormous amount of people who are providing safety. It just depends on what level and to whom, So like you said, you've got programs like Beat the Heat, for those that are don't have a lot of air conditioning when it's 108 degrees outside, or you have barriers for mosquitoes, for Zika virus, and all these different programs that are so important. And then you've got, on top of that, you've got the people providing vaccinations and epidemiology and all the public health response. And then on top of that, you've got the EMS, and you've got the firefighters, and you've got the police, and the emergency managers. So, everybody's providing some kind of safety. It just depends on if it's macro management, macro planning for the whole city, or if you're talking about people that are providing community engagement and direct services, or people like in my line of work where we're providing safety planning for the people that are providing the safety planning for the people that are providing the services. So it's really very interesting, and it certainly couldn't happen without everybody being involved. So that's a great thing. that actually kind of brings us to the next thing here. So I know in both of y'all's cases, it relates to healthcare. You know, like in Amber's case, you discussed, there's acute care hospitals and all different types of organizations of varying sizes, whether they're private or public. And in John's case, you've got the public health, and that of course relates to all of the city services as well as all the partners. You've got SickTrac and you've got all the hospital systems. And so in our case, of course, we have a lot of members with the ASSP as well as AOHP who are in safety, occupational health, and risk management. So they're working for these types of organizations, and typically they'll end up in that kind of role where they're providing either safety management or occupational health services. So question was, in what ways do you feel like healthcare, whether it's acute care or even ambulatory clinics, and public health, where we've got definitely, we've got clinical services, but we've also got all these other programs, including a lot of outreach. In what ways do those differ with emergency management? Are we talking about the same types of planning and preparedness and response, or do you think there's a lot of differences? John, let's start with you this time. What do you think?
I think there's quite a bit of overlap, but there's also some clear demarcations, I guess is a good way to put it. So, you know, even looking at the healthcare system and what we, the services that we do in our public health clinics, they don't match 100% to the services that are available to or through the hospital. So those things kind of really complement each other, right? And even with the private sector doctor's offices that provide primary care, public health is not primary care. So we're trying to get our clients that might be coming to us specifically to get treated or diagnosed for say an STD, but we want to make sure that they actually have a medical home, with a family practitioner or some other kind of primary care provider that they can see for managing all of their conditions, right? Whether it's a chronic illness, those more or less routine infections like common cold, the flu, or even some of the ones that we support, STDs and COVID, those kinds of things. But really having them, have a doctor that they see for those routine visits, wellness checks, and all that kind of stuff. So really trying to promote that, in concert with what we're doing. Then when we're looking at the emergency response side, our healthcare partners are really critical, and we look primarily at how can we protect that infrastructure so that it stays available, especially in the looking at it from the emergency department standpoint, where we want people to be able to call 911 and get to the hospital and get the care that they need, from the car accident that they were in, the heart attack that they're having at home, whatever those critical life events might be, and not be reporting to an emergency department that's overwhelmed with worried well or people who don't know where to go to shelter because it's flooding and they're basically seeking out services that really are not meant to be delivered through the emergency department. So we really want to try and protect that infrastructure and keep it available for those critical needs. And at the same time, it's really important that we monitor that as well. So like during COVID, we're collecting the information from the healthcare system on, just what is the volume of people showing up in the ERs that have influenza-like illness or potential COVID, how many of them are being admitted, how many of those ICU beds are being used to treat COVID, and really giving us good measures of what the impact is being on the community. And that helps to inform some of the actions that we can take, which by and large, again, boil down a lot to messaging, like trying to implement some of these social distancing practices, wearing masks, and taking on practices like, you know, if you're sick, don't report to work or don't go to school. You know, make sure that you're not becoming the vehicle of transmission for these significant public health illnesses. So working with our healthcare partners is really critical. And here in the Houston area, we're quite fortunate that we have a rather exceptional coalition of healthcare partners through SETRAC and the Regional Healthcare Preparedness Coalition. So I think the important message here is that where we have, while we have some overlap and some areas of differences, we really complement each other and work well together to try and take care of you know, our community.
That's great. It's interesting as you were talking about that, it was bringing to mind some of the conversations I've had lately. As a matter of fact, as far as safety protocols for disease exposure prevention is, you know, for example, if we need to prevent exposures to something like a SARS or even something like an Ebola, we know how to do that. You know, it's just a matter of knowing when to implement those protocols. So like you just said, you know, when are we going to implement the capacity limits or the distancing or the source control and all these different things that we can do. And that's kind of the tricky part is knowing at what point does that risk go up, you know, so what's the local infection rate and what's the potential severity of the, you know, of the pathogen in question. And so I think that, you know, what public health does in that regard is so important because they keep the view, the overview of all of these different factors and variables for the whole geographic area, you know, and they're able to provide that, you know, whether it be policy or whether it's recommendations, and that's what gives the people at the tactical level the information they need to know when it's, you know, proverbially when it's time to put on the respirator, you know, or when it's time to start keeping 10 feet between people or whatnot. And all the programs that go on, like tuberculosis control, you know, that all also contributes so that the people at the ER, for example, or at the clinical care unit, they know what's going on in the outside world and what may be coming through the hospital doors. So really interesting stuff. Amber, what are your thoughts on that coming from the healthcare side?
I want to emphasize John's point about the vitality of that collaboration between public health and healthcare entities. COVID was a huge example of that. I think that, like you said, there are some overlap, but there's also a lot of collaboration that needs to happen to keep that overall medical infrastructure available to the community. From an acute care and a clinic standpoint, that really is the bottom line with emergency management, is making sure that we can keep the doors open as long as it's safe to do so. And that we're able to keep that medical infrastructure in place for the community in a time that they most likely need it most. So I think that there's a lot of benefit to a strong collaboration between the two different entities.
That's great. Yeah, it's definitely important. I know having been on either side of that equation at different points in my career, you know, we definitely know that there's a lot to be said about that. Can you give me this 1 second? Let me make sure my audio is not tripping up. Can you all still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I was getting a little weird signal from my device. I want to make sure I wasn't going ghost on it. all right. Awesome. Well, that kind of brings us to the other part of this. So, like we said, you know, we've got all the emergency management going on, we've got the public health going on, and of course, all that feeds into those policies and guidance and recommendations to keep people safe in the public, and that ideally will prevent crises, you know, in the in the acute care world as well. And so on both sides of that, whether we're talking about first responders or whether we're talking about clinical care, or even if we're talking about community outreach or whatnot, then we've got safety and occupational health. And so those of us in our unique profession, you know, we're kind of there to help to make sure that we can mitigate any hazards to those that are volunteering to go forward. And so my question is, in your experiences, you know, how does the local safety advisor or safety officer in the ICS case, how does that person integrate into your work? Do you see them a lot in the field or in the EOC or in the workplace on a day-to-day basis? What have your experiences been like there? Amber, let's start with you this time.
Sure. So I think it depends on the type of incident and the response. So if you're talking about, for example, a patient decontamination response, that safety officer is going to have a very visible presence. If you're talking something that maybe isn't as, I hate to say dangerous, but dangerous for the response, they may not be as visible. And I think, and I don't mean to segue, but for me, I think that's an important point, is when we're in this response mode in the EOC or, you know, boots on the ground response, we're in tunnel vision and we're in disaster mode and we're trying to deal with the situation at hand. And that role of the safety advisor and the safety officer is vital to ensuring that everybody goes home that night, that everyone is safe, that we don't cause a subsequent issue in the middle of the disaster response. So I would encourage anyone in that role to step into, you know, feeling empowered in that role, that I know it can be difficult when everyone is in disaster mode and trying to deal with things, to be like the one feeling like you're putting a wrench in it, like that's not safe, or we really need to sit back and think about this. But that at the end of the day is vital to making sure that, you know, we're putting that oxygen mask on first so we can help others and we can respond to the situation. So I've always been very grateful for the individual in that role and in that ability to make sure that we're all operating in a safe environment.
Cool. Yeah, it's always interesting. You know, if I recall, you may have even been there when we had this conversation. It would have been about 8 years ago, maybe. We were talking about that same topic, about the role of the safety officer. And the conversation was about doing a response, something like a hazmat or a patient decon, different type of situation in the middle of the summer in Texas, where you've got, you know, 108 degrees outside and 120% humidity. And what we were talking about was how something as simple as somebody to monitor and make sure that there's work rest cycles and proper decontamination and hydration and electrolytes are being replenished. And that can be the thing that prevents more casualties, which can turn the whole response sideways. And I remember somebody was there. I don't mean this as a diss or anything, but if I recall, this person was a firefighter, and their comment was that, you know, oh, we're taking care of a hazmat. We're not thinking about a bottle of water, you know. And we said that bottle of water might be the thing that makes you able to respond, you know. And so I appreciate your comments there, because that could be the thing that enables the response to be effective, and not to have a whole bunch of variables such as more casualties or whatnot. John, what are your thoughts on that from the public health side?
So Corey, certainly since you've joined us here at the health department and especially through COVID, it's become more and more apparent just how critical it is to have you know, a real safety professional in that role to identify those hazards and what the appropriate control measures are. You and our biosafety officer have been immensely helpful through, you know, all the COVID response. A few things that come to mind in terms of just different responses we've had or I've been involved with over the years involving safety issues. So this one that comes to mind, it's not from the Houston area, but speaks to, the level of awareness that is needed, in this case, local awareness. And so we were doing some door-to-door canvassing, and the safety officer made a point of letting the staff know who happened to be a mixture of local personnel as well as people that were brought in remotely from other areas of the state. And he pointed out the importance of recognizing purple fence posts, which, I had no idea what that symbol meant, but he was pointing out that that was a clear indication of a potential trespass hazard that could be life-threatening. So if you didn't recognize the purple fence post and enter that person's property, you might risk getting shot. So that kind of awareness, I think, is real critical. And some things you really need to know, kind of the lay of the land and that community. Other pieces, like you've spoken to, on identifying the hazards and knowing those layers of protections that can be implemented, also very critical. So we've had some situations where we haven't had quite as a knowledgeable safety officer available to us, and that focus might stick to some of the more day-to-day concerns that most people understand, slip, trips and falls types of concerns, catching things that tripping hazards, that kind of thing, which hopefully we've raised the level of awareness enough that most people can see those without need of much prompting. But that day-to-day effort and doing activities outside of response, I think, is really, really critical. And those reminders through our monthly meetings, bringing to light during staff meetings and safety meetings some of these issues so that they get a level of awareness, maybe not all of the time, but more of the time, so that people can be more self-aware and more, I guess, safety aware, just where there might be hazards that they could overlook. And for me, on the public health side, a lot of it has to do with different types of exposures, whether it's communicable disease, heat, cold, dehydration. Another scenario that comes to mind was during Ike. I actually had a team that were supporting the EMS operations down in Galveston to help evacuate UTMB. And a lot of that planning was directed from Austin. And those folks didn't recognize that during a major hurricane like Ike, retail outlets like Target, because operations were based out of the Target parking lot, and their assumption was we wouldn't have to worry about water because we could get water from Target. Well, as we're within hours of a hurricane, there's no bottled water to be found in any retail outlet. So it was kind of an oversight that a local safety planning person could see that coming, and unfortunately it had an impact on some of our staff to the point where we had to have them placed on IVs to rehydrate them. So the consequences of uninformed decisions can have some of the safety impacts. And if we don't have that proper ICS hierarchy established to monitor safety situations, then they can go on unmitigated for a time. So we also want to make sure that we're empowering all of our staff, whether they're in operations or planning or admin finance, to participate in that reporting process too, that if they see something, say something, particularly as relates to potential safety concerns, and raise them back to the safety officer so that hopefully they can be resolved quickly, even without the safety officer having to take the intervention himself or herself, but that they're made aware that this happened here, could be happening elsewhere, and to make sure it gets addressed. And it covers such a wide gamut of potential exposures. It could be all kinds of weather issues, like we have with lightning, especially if we're outside, extreme cold, extreme heat, and then a lot of other physical issues like tripping hazards, being around automobiles or other moving equipment. Just all around you is so many potentials for safety hazards to go unmitigated and unrecognized. So I think that safety officer role, it's real critical, and how you go about integrating that really needs to be multifaceted. One, to recognize the importance of assigning that role, but also ensuring that we're raising awareness across the entire ICS platform so that we can easily recognize those hazards and get them resolved.
Awesome. Yeah, it's definitely true. There's a lot. It's kind of something that somebody said to me, maybe it's like 4 or 5 months ago. They had said that we were talking about safety management. They had told me they were talking to students down the street at University of Houston, Clear Lake, where they have a really good safety management degree program. And she had told the students, the thing about safety that most people don't talk about is that the field is about 1 million miles wide and about 1 million miles deep. And so there's so many different potential hazards and threats in there that you have to kind of constantly be looking to identify them. And then once you identify them, then you have to figure out, what's the risk level, because of course it ranges, like you said, everything from a slip, trip and fall, all the way to, some of these things like a pandemic, for example, that, we haven't seen in 100 years, and now we're very, very familiar with it. So it's interesting. I used to always use that as an example for risk assessment is, risk assessment is frequency and severity. And I used to say that it's kind of like if you talked about a velociraptor attack, it's like, yeah, you're going to die, but it's probably never going to happen, short of, science fiction. But
never say never.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll jinx myself. Tomorrow there'll be a YouTube video of a velociraptor.
Have you seen Jurassic Park?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny you say that. There was a little clip somebody put on social media. It said on the headline. It said some scientist or some lab. They said they're inching closer to being able to clone or something. Being able to use dinosaur DNA, and the only thing they put on there, put apparently they have not seen any of the 5 Jurassic Park movies. Those don't end well ever.
Nope.
Yeah. But yeah, there's so much stuff in that it can certainly pop up, and we've definitely need to be aware of that. So that kind of brings to the last question. So at this point, we've talked about, we got the emergency management process where we're able to do the planning, preparedness, response, recovery, and then that applies differently, whether we're talking about public service, public health, or if we're talking about first response, or if we're talking about acute care, either way, same EM cycle, but we're talking about different clientele, so to speak, different operations. And then we got that safety officer who's involved there, whether it's on a day-to-day basis for the occupational side of it, or whether it's on a full tilt response and they're thinking about high severity hazards like infectious disease or hazardous materials or things of that nature. So y'all have been involved in all of that, in many capacities from everything you've been talking about. So if you were talking to somebody that showed up tomorrow and they said, I'm your new safety advisor, what's something that you would relay to them that you'd like to see to make sure that they're providing what you need and that'll help them to be successful in their role and providing, effective and efficient safety leadership? What's something that you would impart to them? John, let's start with you this time. What do you think?
Well, Corey, I'm hoping that I have the opportunity to introduce them to you and to model some of their actions based on the things that you've been doing here at the health department. So I think probably the strongest message I would give them is really know their stuff, but also understand that in most cases, applying the Ericky of controls is really about understanding the layers and the potential triggers for when do you need what complement of controls, right? Because like you're saying, we know what all the control measures are for COVID, but do we need to be implementing all of them, in every situation, or are there situations where we can pare that down? And I think that's the thing that can get lost in some of these conversations, and how you approach that, like presenting, here are the control options. Here is that risk assessment, whether it's a low, moderate, or severe threat. Best understand that, and to take those appropriate steps. And then long term, to establish a rapport with those folks that you're working with, whether it's other partners in the ICS structure and the department or business programs, or the rank and file coworkers, if you will, so that you establish that relationship, that level of trust, and that understanding that you're providing an ongoing service through different modalities. So for instance, putting out messaging to all employees via email, hosting webinars accessible to all employees, or having committees to try and really identify, where do we have significant safety concerns, or equally important, where are we doing exceptionally well at controlling these concerns? Because hearing the good news is important too. So I think all of those things are quite important. And as with everything else in emergency planning and emergency response, it's really about having those relationships and that reputation, so that you're building everything on the foundation of trust.
Awesome. Yeah, that's definitely wise. It's interesting what you were just talking about there is I was talking to some people from National Safety Council earlier, and that same thing got brought up where there's this unfortunate thing that happens with safety leaders every now and then where it may be because they're just not they're not reading the room, and they're kind of they're thinking kind of like I got to fill my quota, and so they're not thinking about the other side of it is, how it's being perceived by others, or they might, just not be present in the moment or whatnot. But they'll constantly hit on all the negatives. They'll say this is wrong, and this risk is uncontrolled, and these people are not following the safety protocol, and I haven't got the money for this equipment that we need, and people are just eventually going, we really just don't want you around. You're really kind of you're almost counterproductive at that point. And same thing applies when you get those situations where they go, like we know with a hierarchy of controls, you know, you've got elimination, substitution, engineering. So they'll go, I want to see this hazard eliminated, you know, and the rest of the organization is going, I know that's the safest thing to do, but if we eliminate that hazard, that means we're also eliminating the ability to operate, you know. So it's like, there's this, I don't want to say compromise, but it just has to work out to where it's the most effective control within the scope of that operation. Otherwise, you know, nothing happens. It's kind of like the old cliche. It's like, we made the operation so safe that everybody went home. You know, it's like we have no reason to be here anymore because we can't work. So those are definitely great points, and definitely impactful from your position. Amber, what do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
So from an emergency management perspective, and I mean, this applies to any role, but I would first and foremost want to make sure that they're familiar with the ICS structure, with the communication flow, with the command and control concepts, just to make it easier for them as they integrate into that response effort. So it's mainly, this is not something they do as a large part of their job. I would also encourage them to ensure they're integrated into the mitigation and planning part of these responses, where they can be proactive about building safety considerations into the plans before they're activated, and then also supporting that safety culture for the response and for those different tactics and pieces.
Definitely. Yeah, that's a great point. The proactive part of it is really important. There, again, it's that same difference between, you know, being part of the solution and building the relationships and having a productive voice versus just being the safety cop, you know, running around trying to find things that are wrong and trying to fix them all on the back end. So that's definitely important. And also, like you said, there is, you know, understanding the construct is, there's lately that there's a lot more of that being taught in safety management, where especially in like graduate programs, where there's needs to be an understanding of, you know, not only emergency management but also epidemiology and toxicity and things of that nature that get a little bit further away from occupational hazards. But it also takes a lot for the individual safety leader to go to find those things, because we found out with the pandemic, it was one of those things that you have a lot of people that do safety for a living, but very few of them had ever worked with infectious disease. And there was a lot of in-house training and we did a lot of stuff with ASSP, National Safety Council, AOHP, a lot of webinars, a lot of training. We're even to this day, we're still doing conference presentations to make sure that should something like this come back, another SARS, or we dealt with monkeypox this summer and now, and we got the potential for Ebola, which we're praying does not happen. And there's a need for it. So even though they may not be infection preventionists in a hospital, there's a need to understand how contamination control and all these things work and how those respirator programs tie into it. So great points from both of y'all. But with all that being said, I know we're kind of coming up on the hour and y'all are busy people, so I want to respect your time. John, is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap it up?
No, I think we touched on some great stuff between the three of us, so nothing more to add here.
Cool, thank you. How about yourself, Amber?
Well, I just want to thank you, Corey, for bringing us together to have this conversation. It's great to hear the integration of emergency management into safety and during COVID was so interesting because safety was a concern within the EOCs or the command centers because you have a communicable virus. And so those safety officers played a big role in trying to convince everyone, look, I know you're used to being in this room, in this role, in this response, but we have to take into consideration your safety of having a bunch of people in a room during a pandemic. And so it definitely, they played a vital role in this response. So I'm really grateful to have this conversation today.
Awesome. Yeah, and that's definitely true. It's definitely an interesting experience, and certainly glad to talk to y'all. I always take it as a compliment that, you know, the people I've known over the years are still willing to talk to me. You know, it's I always think it's like I haven't gotten written off. That's good, you know. So I certainly appreciate y'all's time and your, you know, dedication to all of this, especially being willing to provide this professional development forum. So we'll go ahead and wrap it up then, so I can not take up your whole evening. But for everybody listening, if you haven't heard it yet, definitely check out the podcast. We're located at anchor.fm/ASSP-HCPS-HealthBeat. And the AOHP podcast is anchor.fm/AOHP. We're up to 43 episodes, and so we've got a lot of fantastic topics and really, really great speakers, including today's. Otherwise, we have a webinar for ASSP actually tomorrow. So if you don't hear this before then, you can find the replay. It's going to be with Pete Suska, who is the CEO of OPX Safety, and he's going to be talking about how to integrate safety into holistic process management. And he does that with all kinds of clientele across the whole world. So that'll be a good one. And then otherwise, there's a replay of our webinar that we did on Halloween with Sean Galloway, who is the CEO of PROACT Safety, and Norman Ritchie, who is over VPSI. And they talked about the high reliability principles and what that means for safety leadership. We also had enough follow-on questions from that webinar. We did another one with just myself, Sean, and Norman, and we just went through the rest of the questions so that they could answer those without having to write individual essays to answer them. So those are all available for replay now, and we're going to have more coming up in the new year. We're going to be talking to the ASSP Blacks in Safety Excellence, as well as the Women in Safety Excellence, and the Hispanic safety professionals. So definitely check that one out. It's going to be fantastic. But otherwise, we'll wrap it up tonight, and we'll talk to everybody real soon. Have a great day.